In today's episode, Cynthia Nelson, an authority in video commerce and supporter of women in business, joins us for an inspiring episode. We explore e-commerce, video, and social commerce and the 2024 marketing landscape. We delve into Cynthia's work with women-led companies, the evolution of the e-commerce industry, and AI's role in marketing. Prepare for a journey of insight and empowerment in today's dynamic tech environment. Welcome to the Ecom Pulse, your heartbeat to the world of e-commerce. Join us as we meet industry leaders, innovative entrepreneurs, and passionate professionals who are at the forefront of the e-commerce revolution. From groundbreaking technologies to marketing magic, Ecom Pulse is your insider's guide to all things e-commerce. So plug in, gear up, and get ready for a pulse-pounding journey into the heart of e-commerce. Welcome, everybody. I'm very excited today about our guest, Cynthia Nelson. Cynthia brings wealth of experience with over 25 years in leadership roles in both startups and corporate environments. Cynthia is three times the founder and expert in video commerce and dedicated supporter of women in business. Welcome, Cynthia. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Okay, it's great to have you here. Cynthia, we know each other probably for the last year. And obviously, you know, get to know you through the live shopping posts and video commerce and obviously the podcast. But, you know, then you started posting about women entrepreneurs and then about your investment and about the board. It's like layers and layers and it's keep coming. So it will be great if you can share with us and you can start whatever you want, yeah. You know, about your professional background, about your experience. How did you end up here and what are you working on these days?
Sure. So I started as a fine art major in college. Wow. And then realized, I'm probably not going to make any money doing this. And I switched to business and I found myself literally not liking the business class. Like, why am I taking this? It's not practical learning. And this was in the early 80s. And a company was advertising, you know, on the job board, college job board, right? Pinned up, right? Nothing electronic in those days. There was a receptionist at a computer company. And I was like fascinated, like, what is computer? Like, what is this thing? You know, and I started working there and they were repairing PCs, XTs, ATs, their first Apple Mac, Apple Lisa, which people forgot about, which was one of the original ones. And so I was fascinated by that whole, you know, it's a new industry that I'd never really heard of. So I fell in love with tech. Actually, I dropped out of college, became a partner in that business, ended up failing miserably. And my partner ended up suing. Like, it was not a good, it was a good experience in a lot of ways to have it really early on, I think. It taught me a lot of great lessons. But I ended up working at Ingram Micro, which is a big computer distributor, global distributor of computers. So that was an amazing experience, and then was headhunted to work for Barry Diller's first investments in the internet, which was Internet Shopping Network. So that was a precursor of Amazon, although Jeff Bezos was already working with one of Ingram Micro's sister companies, Ingram Book. So Amazon was already in its stages, you know, early stages in the 90s, and he was learning the book distribution business, and that's actually how he started it. But I was very lucky. I kind of just was the person who would always like raise my hand. Oh, I'll do it. That's crazy. I'll do it. And I just kept volunteering to jump into things I had no idea. Like, I guess a fake it till you make it thing. And worked in the advertising world at Tribal DDB and the strategy side, early stage with them. And then was in Miami for 10 years and built a company with three other women called Todo Bebe, which means everything baby in Spanish. Like, it's a nice gringita like me doing in a place like this kind of thing. I had been married to a Latina, so I understood the family dynamic and having a family and having kids at center of the universe. And so we built the first 360 media company around parenting and pregnancy in Spanish.
Wow.
We were the first ones with television programming every week on Telemundo. And then we had 4 years on Telemundo, another 4 years on Univision. And we had books. We definitely did licensing at the end of the 10 years. We did licensing. of products, internet, obviously. We had radio programming snippets. So we really touched retailtainment. We did, you know, in parking lot events with Walmart across the country, which I said after I did five of them, I'm like, I'm never doing this again. Yeah. We have to find a better way if we want to do events. This is a big pain in the ass. And it's a lot of work. But so we did virtual events. We started doing virtual events where people would sign up and they'd receive a box with samples in it from all of our sponsors. Okay. They'd open them up. They'd take pictures of them using the product, playing with their kids. It was called a fiesta, Viva la Familia Fiesta, and a fiesta box. And they would celebrate. And on one day, we had 500,000 people across the country celebrating with us and uploading photos and videos to this you know, site that we had built just for that. So this is like, again, pre-social media even.
Of course.
And then we took on equity investors in 2008. And then we sold it in 2000 to a public company in 2012. And I came back to New York.
Amazing.
And I've been consulting, strategy consulting for, you know, Sony Music and Audible and a bunch of small companies. And I found that women just weren't getting the investment. I mean, it's really piss poor. And yet they return higher revenue. They return higher rates. They have better exits than all male founded companies. And I started investing in, and I have two or three investments now, in one in AI called Binge, and another one, which was over a drink one time of, oh my God, if I do one more pro forma for somebody raising capital, because people don't know how to do them. Yeah. They're always wrong. There's always issues. They underestimate their cash burn. And so a friend of mine, Sandra Galt, created a company called Recurved, and you put in your information. It literally blows out a 3 or 5 year pro forma, all the bells and whistles. You can show pieces to your investors. Investors use it and make their companies use it. So they have a bird's eye view of what's happening. There's an app for it. I mean, she's really done a fantastic job, and it's really solving a problem for, I mean, everybody that I know who raises capital. You know, should just be paying to use the software. Why do it yourself? So that's kind of rolls back to like background, but also why I'm investing in women run companies other than the other things I do. Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously your investment.
You're very long-winded.
Yeah. So your investment criteria are, I mean, you like probably the tech, you like the opportunity, and obviously it's a woman-led founders, right? So that's another component.
Yeah, I don't do a lot of product side.
Yeah.
On the product piece, I'm not a product expert, right? So I tend to try to stay in my lane. I've seen some tech that I really like, but again, I wasn't an expert in those. It was a luxury tech. I wasn't an expert in that. So I was like, you know, it has to be something that I believe I can add value, not just money. Because a lot of times they're seed investments, they're early angel investments, where the money is interesting and good for them, but it's really not the money. They literally want me to be an advisor, you know, to help them be an advisor, help them with their debt, help them to find investors. It's more than just that. So if I'm going to put my time in, then I have to be really accretive to their business.
Sure. That's the strategic advisory role that you put in place, you know, beyond the investment itself, which is so important for founders, right?
Yeah.
So great. I mean, you host the Let's Talk About Live Shopping podcast. I mean, you've definitely been very active in the last year, you know, covering this area with the amazing, you know, success that started in China probably 3 years ago. You know, Western world, definitely US, is trying to cope for creating, you know, its own version of live shopping or video commerce or whatever it will evolve to. And you've been speaking to a lot of, you know, CEO and founders of various tech companies in this sector. Yeah. So from your perspective, you know, after, you know, so much experience from the industry side and also from the tech side, what do you think is the current status of live shopping, and what are probably the biggest, you know, challenges of it to be widely adopted even more than it is today?
I think the biggest, I think, there's just upside right now. The market is crowded, I think, the U.S. has become crowded with products, the platform side. And you know, the obvious is the platform has to work perfectly, right? So the platforms have to just work no matter what. I think the challenge is coming from brands that think that they just post one time and that's it. It's over and it didn't work. You know, this whole you didn't do that with Facebook. It's been 10 years on Facebook, right? Or more than 10 years.
Yeah.
It's like, this is a strategy, and you're not going to build or launch a new product without going in and doing your homework and doing your research and understanding the market and the demographic. That's the same thing with live shopping. It's not the panacea, the end all, you know, the next coming of any. This is just it's spoke in your wheel of marketing. And it should actually be used across all the types of marketing, right? Because some of it is, selling, some of it is educational. You may have live selling shows where really it's educational about the product. And yes, the product is there and you're selling it, and your call to actions may be softer selling because it's a more technical product you need to get across. But the type of data that you can get out of it is extreme now. And marketers are, you know, no longer is a CMO all about the brand and brand marketing. You know, now marketers need to reach across every area of the company, including operations, product development, engineering, the data analytics and research teams. And I think we're going to see a whole new level of CMO coming that comes from direct selling or direct marketing, where data is king.
Yes.
I do talk to CMOs as well. And in fact, a friend of mine, Carissa Price, who was a direct marketer when I met her, you know, 15 years ago, direct response marketer 15 years ago, did a turn at Walmart as well. She did a couple startups herself. She's now the CMO of a company called Dragonfruit AI, which is a really phenomenal platform for retailers. And she said she's stunned when she talks to other CMO marketers that they don't have the data analytics background and they're having to use other people in the company and having to learn it. And she's like, I'm so glad I did 10 years in direct response, because it's everything. It's the whole funnel in direct response. You're capturing and looking at every single, and she was buying television commercials at that point. So it's expensive, right? So if it didn't work, it didn't turn the dial, the call to action, like boom, they changed it and they moved on, but they were really looking at, you know, getting people down the funnel. And I think live shopping is this tool that marketers, you know, need to use, but they need to understand the data analytics behind it too. I think what's holding people up is they're still sticking the toe in the water and they're not committing to it as a strategy. And I think internally you have to have a champion. If you don't have a champion internally at a brand that's going to kind of power through the proof of concepts, you're screwed.
Yeah.
It won't catch on. It won't work.
Sure. Obviously, technology is not the barriers these days, right? There are so many alternatives out there. I mean, if you're on Shopify or Magento, BigCommerce, whatever, any of these platforms, it's really straightforward to integrate these technologies.
Yeah.
But it's also, there is another layer, which is all the video production and the scripting and sourcing the talent and knows exactly what to do with them. And it's not kind of an organic, you know, post on Instagram. It's more like a sales type probably a short form video. So it's an ecosystem of arts, of technology, of, you know, various things. And I think probably anyhow, it won't be like the major revenue source of any brands or retailers, but I think it's very, very powerful in building like brand loyalty, customer engagement, and definitely the data, right? This data that you aggregate from video and engagement that users are having with the video, I think it's so powerful that it must be like a, you know, part of the any marketeer, you know, these days.
Yeah, it's, I completely agree with you in that.
Yeah,
you know, it's not what live selling is. Is this is not new. People like go look at what QVC and HSN have been doing. This has been around for 50 years.
Yeah,
it's not new. Like there is a formula for creating a live show. It doesn't have to be 3 hours long. It can be 15 minutes, but there's a formula around, and there's a formula, the call to action. And you know, you mentioned Don Chubé also, who, you know, the expert in the talent training side, you know, just because you have an influencer that you work with doesn't mean that they can sell.
Correct.
I mean, it just doesn't. Correct. I don't care if they have 20 million followers. It doesn't mean they could be great on what they do, but it doesn't really mean that they can sell. So I think that part is extremely important. Yeah. And the other thing is distribution. Where are you going to push this besides your paid, earned, own media channels?
Correct.
Can you build partnerships with other publishers? Do you have an access to other places where this video, this shoppable video content can go? Like, because the more people that see it, right, higher brand awareness and eventually conversion.
Correct. And this is another aspect. I mean, the live shopping part, but on the other side, we have the, let's call it video commerce or social commerce, which is like, well, this is like booming right now. You know, eMarketer just published this week that 100 million buyers or shoppers in the US actually purchased on social in 2023. Yeah. So this is like growing very, very fast. Yeah. There is a big budget, marketing budget going to video commerce, right? Or social commerce. Yes. This is something that is definitely taking place. Video obviously is the main vehicle for any of these activities. And the live shopping video is also one important ingredient of all this, you know, integrative strategy, which I think obviously is going to be really deployed and more implemented here. Now, you mentioned Dawn, and what I like with Dawn is obviously her experience and the way she delivered the training and the consulting services, but also she's building a roster of talents, like professional or certified sellers that are able to stand in front of a camera, you know, make it attractive, respect the audience, and probably, you know, gain experience in various niches, like you have sellers for cosmetics and fashion and jewelry, other one maybe for
all
sport,
the categories.
Jewelry.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is, I think, important, providing a like a holistic, complete package to the brands, technology, and a array of services, both talent, scripting, you know, production services, and also how to deploy them, you know, across the multi-channel aspect.
Exactly.
So definitely, I mean, exciting times ahead. It's, we just started, you know, in the US, and it looks really, really, you know, impressive. And I mean, the data and what's
the difference. You mentioned the social selling side, right? I don't have a problem with it, obviously, at all, because most platforms stream directly to the social platforms anyway, and you can, if you have a native integration, you can buy within the video. But just having a Facebook Live strategy only.
Yep.
This is a cookie-less world, remember now.
Yes.
You are not going to get any data from Meta.
Correct.
About those, like, not zero, end of story, nothing. You don't get data. You know, we're going back to where we were 10 years ago, before social media, where you need to build a database of your own customers so that you can literally do instant research with them, find out what you think they need, a new, you know, feature in your product. They could care less. What they want is this other feature to work better, faster, harder for them, right? But without that direct consumer knowledge, right? And having them, speaking to them, talking to them, and it happens on Facebook, but I think when you're selling to them directly, you know, your direct to consumer sales channels, again, building those databases, we went from all having those databases, right, to putting everything on social. We kind of forgot about email marketing over here, but it's so powerful. It's live email marketing, live sales. It's so powerful to have those, all those channels actually working and igniting each other, because someone actually likes to watch a video. Someone wants to listen to a podcast. Someone else, oh, I like the emails because they're short and sweet, and I get them and I click, click, click. You have to build that database.
Sure.
And a lot of brands had forgotten about it, or never were direct sellers. You know, many big brands were never direct sellers anyway, right? They were always selling at retail. And again, retail doesn't give you shit either.
Correct.
They don't give you the POS data. Like, that doesn't come, like, you just know how many widgets you sold. You have know nothing about the consumer. And I think that's where direct to consumer live selling video really can help brands build those active databases and personas of consumers and really then start serving them much more personalized.
Correct.
Using AI too, right? Much
of
more
course.
Personalized messages.
Of course. By the way, the cookieless world actually gives rise to a new big opportunity that is emerging with retail media, right?
Yes.
Because the retailers, the online retailers, can give you like exact data, right? Shoppers are buying, when, you know, where. And this data is like gold in a cookieless world. And you see the numbers of, in retail media, it's like the next big, huge opportunity that is coming up.
It's been around for a long time, by the way. It's been called omnichannel, a bunch of other things.
Yeah.
Now it's all retail media. You know, a person who's, I think, one of a great expert in it is Drew Cashmore, who built Walmart Connect in Canada and then was on the U.S. team as well. He was at TikTok for like, not TikTok. He was at one of the live shopping platforms, Firework, for like a minute.
Firework.
And now he's consulting specifically in, you know, in retail media and that whole thing. And in talking to him, it's like, oh, we're like reinventing the wheel. Like, it's been around forever. Retail media has been around a long time, but it just hasn't become this new, woo. And, you know, these are cyclical, right? Every 5 years, it's kind of cyclical. Something comes out. But a lot of this stuff has been around, but yeah, it's getting a lot of hype now. But again, data.
Sure. So if we think about, you know, the marketeer from the brand side, about CMOs waking up in the morning, right? I mean, what can you advise them? I mean, what do they need to pay attention to in 2024? What do you think the biggest opportunity or, you know, hurdles going into the new year?
I mean, the hurdles are that we have a very, you know, attention span of a gnat. You know, everybody's got, we're flooded with, and we talk about live commerce, right? Why live shopping took off in China. It's a very segmented group that actually communicates on like three platforms. Like, that's it. Everything's done within one particular app, banking, you know, messaging, banking, communicate, like every, so it's focused right here. And basically rest of the world too, we're so non-focused. I mean, how many channels do you know what's on Netflix? Do you actually, like, how many channels can you have, right? Of entertainment, of data, of information, of disinformation, you know? So our attention span as consumers is so short. For marketers, being able to understand the consumer, again, the data is going to be the key. Understand the consumer and being able to do quick and fast testing, where I really think is AI is going to come in and play a great role, is being able to create, you know, scripts, creative, do things very fast. Of course, human touch has to be there to make sure it works the right way, but speed those proof of concepts up, speed those A/B testing pieces up, do them automated on the fly so that you can affect your creative and messaging and marketing and get great feedback to your product development teams and engineering teams, right? So if I was a CMO, I would be, you know, a data head, learning as much as I can about the tools that are out there that are going to make my job more effective and easier, especially with smaller companies that don't have, you know, swaths of people around them. You know, like you have to have an entrepreneur. I think in a big company, having an entrepreneur mindset is very difficult because there's always somebody else. Oh, that's not in my lane. Somebody else really does it. So I have to wait for them to finish it, to get it over here. I think, you know, having marketing teams that include all other areas of the company as advisors on it make a lot of sense because it's touching every part of the company now.
Correct. All right. Again, one of the key differences between, you know, China or Asia to the US, I mean, China is just, I mean, they're using these super apps, right? And you do everything in one app. And in the US, I mean, if you're marketing, you need to think about Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and Snap, right? And then and Twitch and YouTube. I mean, and then, you know, different marketplaces. And now Shopify is in the game with marketplaces and, you know, open platforms. I mean, it's so fragmented, right? Maybe it's an opportunity, maybe it's a challenge. But, you know, building communities around these environments is very, very, you know, challenging, I think.
It's very
complex. Time consuming. It's very confusing and it's changing so fast. And the attention span is getting lower and lower. So, it's going to be an exciting year,
I think. I think you need to choose battles as a marketer, right? You can't be everything to everyone on every platform. Exactly. I don't think it works.
Yeah.
I think if you're a, you know, multinational global brand like a Coke, right? Like they're everything to everyone on every platform. Basically, they're everywhere, right? But if you're, that's, they're very few and far between. But where do they really, like, if you look at their marketing strategy, where do they spend the most money? They spend the most money in the places that get them the most return.
Returns, yeah. You know,
right? So as a marketer, if you're looking at all these channels, figure out a strategy, figure out your KPIs, test it. Don't just do it once, test it. For 3 months.
Yes.
And then you'll figure out which one actually is going to give you a better. It doesn't mean you're going to drop Facebook because it's not working. You'll keep a presence, but you're going to not dump the same amount of money in that as you are going to do an Instagram, because Instagram just is where your customer lives. Like, where does that customer live most often? And, you know, your target audience. And then, you know, and I was mentioning Binge. One of the things it does, and it's personality driven, right? So you can literally type in a sentence and it'll find. Yes, here's your total market. but here's this whole group of people that are talking about your brand and things that are related to it that are untapped that you didn't even know about. And they may be in places and following other people that you didn't know about, but they're untapped because their personality is the same as the type of people that buy your products today or that talk about your products today. So I think that's the other, like, finding the untapped audiences. Because I, you know, I'm X age living in New York as a woman, blah, 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 right? So somebody in California, same age, living as a woman in California, like, okay, just because of the same age and even if we went to the same high school, for example, it doesn't mean that our personalities are the same.
Yeah.
Right? Even though we watch some of the same Netflix shows, they don't know that I'm a rabid equestrian and I need to watch the Olympics in the middle of the night. I'll be, you know, watching, I'll be getting up and watching, you know, those things. So, you know, if the more you know about your consumer, the more you can kind of cross map these untapped audiences on top of it and expand because they're really also talking about the product too and looking at it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so fragmentation is like a key theme and communities around, you know, different fragments and going to be a key challenges for marketeers, obviously. And now, I mean, this is the time of any podcast that we need to talk about AI, right? So, I mean, trying to figure out what's working and what's not. Obviously, there's so much, you know, buzz and hype around that. But the real, you know, use cases that you can really use in real life are very limited. So, yeah, I would love your perspective of what you see.
I mean, it's such a big AI, I always call AI, E-I-E-I-O, A-I-O. Because everybody's, you know, everybody's using the word, throwing it around. And I think a lot of people don't know really what it means.
Yeah.
There's so many variations of it, right?
Sure.
You know, what it is and what it's not. I think that there's, again, people using AI and saying the word all the time and they don't really know. They think it's ChatGPT and that's like very much the baseline tiny part of what AI can do. It's an explosion of companies, you know, coming out of the woodwork that are doing things.
Floods of startups,
getting funded. They're on a piece of paper, like back in the 90s. Oh, here's my idea. Please fund me. And it's people are getting money. And I'm like, because for AI and ML to machine learning to work, it takes a long time and a lot of data in order to have those data sets and those analytics that actually are accurate enough to build a product around.
Yeah.
You know, Binge has been going on. I've invested 4 years ago. Like, you know, now we have, you know, 18 billion data sets and 192 sources and, you know, 5 billion actionable data, but 4 years in the making, you know, that this stuff takes time. So as a marketer, I think if you're investing in AI, you need to look at the places where it's going to be the most functional and practical for you, right? That, you know, and that you can integrate it, simple, easy integration into what you're doing already. There's a bunch of, you know, out for retailers, Dragonfruit, which I mentioned, you know, they have great simple integration into a tech stack where, you know, I didn't even realize this, but in any store, retail store, there are cameras everywhere, right? And they're capturing tons of data. But to go in and install a new camera system in 500 stores that happens to have AI technology built into it, I mean, it's a huge ticket.
Yes.
It's a huge spend that no...
Take years.
I was going to say, like, absolutely, we can't do this. But like with their technology, you don't have to do that. You can use the existing cameras and you can map a customer journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you pull that data back in.
With the existing infrastructure. Yeah.
And you're able to say, hey, store number 75, we thought you weren't selling these white hoodies, but guess what? They're not even out on the floor. And your retail display it's not pulling people to the right department to rather than waiting till the quarter ends and you're like, oh, Cynthia's store number 5 sold out of white hoodies, but you know, Jeff's store number 5 didn't sell at all. Oh, well, you found out that they never even got put out on display. They were in the stock during that promo period, right? So like that's an easy, like over install it with no heavy tech lift, with APIs that are built and SDK and just dropping it in. Like that's those are like solution-based.
Solution that's seamlessly integrated to the current environment and are ready to deploy like immediately. Yeah,
exactly. I think there should be training as part of your like onboarding to a new company. There should be AI training.
Yeah.
You know, what parts of your job, and I think younger generations actually are so much better at it because they're digital natives from the beginning, right?
Sure.
They're already playing with AI. They should be walking in the door and telling you what products we should be using in our companies.
Hmm. Yeah.
They should listen in on board meetings. I mean, obviously stuff is confidential in board meetings, but giving their opinions as the new generation coming in, you know, I think companies, if they don't have a Gen Z person on their board or on their advisory council, then I think they're missing out.
Sure.
Because they're in the deep, you know, really deep in the product side, and they're seeing things changing before they're leveling up to the CEO level. And it can help you, you know, test stuff quickly and pivot before your, you know, competitor does. But we should get AI training walking the door. And I think even a job position, what do you know about, question, what do you know about AI? How have you used AI in it's your current marketing role, whatever? Yeah. Have somebody talk about it. If they don't know anything
about
it.
How do you use AI in your day-to-day work, right?
In your day-to-day work. Yeah. How do you use it today?
Yeah.
If they don't have an answer for it, so either A, they need training, or B, ooh, might not be the right person for you. Because that's a skill set I think everybody's going to have.
It's a basic and it's a must. Yeah. So Cynthia, in your advisory practice, you have the strategy as a service model. So can you please describe it and how it can benefit, you know, startups?
Yeah, I mean, it really is about figuring out, and this is, it kind of goes back to the live stream or video, you know, video commerce side, right? Mm-hmm. We go in and we have a framework called Connect IQ, and we literally go in and look at talent and talent training, content, the product side, technology, you know, what distribution you currently have, and, you know, your research, your analytics side, your data side, right? And look at all of those and say, if you're going to institute video commerce, here's how you score in these areas. So here are the gaps, right? We do a gap analysis. Here are the gaps. And these are five strategies that you need to employ to fill these gaps so you'll become successful at doing video commerce. So sometimes we're just delivering the strategy with the gap, and other times we're delivering strategy and we're doing implementation as well. But
also implementation, okay.
Products, technologies, people, training, influencers, creators, platforms, distribution plans. So we make recommendations on all of those as well.
Amazing. Amazing.
That's why we call it, you know, SaaS, our strategy as a service.
Yes, it's another SaaS version. Yes, SaaS strategy as a service are really, really exciting. Regarding your activities with, women-led companies and, working with women founders.
Yeah.
I would love to hear more about that. And how do you see, you know, women founders evolve throughout the years? And what is the current status of women-led founders in the industry these days?
There are, you know, increasingly more and more women founders, because I think also that if COVID taught us anything, which was we don't need to work in an office every day, especially women and people with families. Mm-hmm. They're missing out, you know, burning the candle at both ends, commuting to these offices. The advertising world, you know, got turned on its, you know, upside down. You know how much real estate we have available in New York right now?
Yep.
Office real estate, I think it's 30 Empire State Buildings worth of office, open office space we have today in the city. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's huge, right? I can tell you that from a woman's founder perspective, starting a business, because now there are all these tools that you didn't have before. These tools are all available. They're cheap. MailChimp, QuickBooks, Canva, like amazing Canva, story with Canva.
Calendly,
there's just all these great, very inexpensive, under $100 a month. You can have all these services at your fingertips and be able to create your own brand and create your own company. So I think women are far exceeding men actually in starting companies. The flip side of it is that statistically, and this is like not me, it's McKinsey and everybody else who reports. Mm-hmm. They return higher from the investment side. They return better investments to their investors.
Wow.
And higher exits.
Interesting.
Women, mm-hmm. with women, not just led, but with women, you know, as co-founders, right?
As co-founders.
Versus just an all male, a male founder or male mm-hmm. males with co-founders as males. So statistically, they just do better, more collaborative. I think we're penny pinchers because we're spending 85% of the money in the family. We're the ones making decisions. The CFO, the chief doctor, that, you know, we're making all these decisions. So we're balancing a lot. So that's a great founder tech, you know, title, right? You got to wear a lot of hats at the beginning, right? You got to be the PR person and the podcaster and write material and talk to clients and sell and close deals and then do the work, right? We're used to balancing a lot of things. So I think that that is super helpful. Financially, though, we get nothing in terms of the capital. It's less than 2% of venture capital goes to women. Even in companies that are funding women, I have heard, and this is very, very, very recent, one of the startups I know, it's founded by a woman, went in, was pitching to a woman inside of a VC. And I'm not tacking a huge VC, but a VC nonetheless with a, you know, an LP group. And the woman said, and it's a technology product. The woman said, you know, you probably need to get a male co-founder, you know.
Wow.
And she said, I don't understand. She's a three-time entrepreneur too.
Wow.
I
don't know
what you're talking about. She said, well, that's just how it is around here. And she said, I said, what, are, you know, oh my, first of all, my God, I would have died. And what did you say? And she said, I told her I felt really sorry for her, that she felt like in that position that I needed to have a male co-founder because that's how her company works. She said, I think you're in the wrong company.
Wow. Correct. Yeah. Exactly.
But that is not, uncommon. I've had other ones who were 4 or 5 months pregnant and they said, well, how are you going to manage this with a baby coming? Like how? And she's like, I had a restaurant and I had 4 kids when I ran a restaurant. You know what a restaurant's like? 24/7.
Yeah.
Like doing that, but they still are getting these very biased groups. And if you go to women of color, it's like less than, it's like 0.8%. It's just flawed all over the place.
Yes.
I think there need to be more women who, when they've made money, they need to be investors as well. Like that's the only way to change the system is when you make money, you need to then turn around and become, you know, become an LP, you know, in a fund, start your own fund, invest directly in things you believe in. That's what I've tried to do, at least on my side, but it's a pretty pitiful investment. Again, it's just, it is what it is. So a lot of them bootstrap. Yes. In fact, I was listening to a great podcast this morning by somebody I really have a lot of admiration for, Stephanie Natty Olson, who started a company called We Are Rosie way before the pandemic. Mom of two, kids were really little. And she just said, there has to be a better way to work. And we have to, you know, in the advertising industry, there has to be a better way to work. And so We Are Rosie actually now has 25,000 Rosies around the country, mostly women that do all different types of marketing. They're experts in all different types of areas of marketing. And she has clients like Google and Facebook and American Express.
Amazing.
She was valued at $100 million. The thing about her that I love, and this, it was called Hype Women is the name of the podcast, by the way, that she was just on, I think a week ago, and I think I posted about it today, but she literally just stepped down as the CEO because she was starting to have physical problems, you know, and admitting like stepping down as CEO and everything that came to her is really stepping back as a CEO, running a company with five people versus running a company with 100 people. It's very different skill set. And
very
she
different.
Literally was having physical problems.
Physical problems, burnout.
She burnout, completely, you know, she couldn't be her best self, you know, running 100 miles an hour, 100% of the time, and, you know, and working 80 hours a week.
Yeah, no balance.
Her fear of stepping back was, oh my God, what are people going to say? Oh, there's some scandal. Oh, you know, her investors pushed her out. Oh, like all these things that came out. I said, yeah, women face, like, that's like a true story of what you know, went on in her head of, oh shit, mm-hmm. people are going to say things. But she said, to be my best self and to let the company really grow, I had to step back and become the chairman. She, you know, she lost 30 pounds. She takes her kids to school. You know, she's doing things yeah. that she missed out on for those five really stressful years. And by the way, they didn't raise any money till way late in the game. Huh. She did it all yeah, by herself, bootstrapped completely. Yeah, yeah completely. Because she knew she wasn't going to get any money.
Exactly. And when everything worked right and growth is like happening, everyone wants to jump in, right?
It's like, yeah. I just said this to somebody the other day. If you've watched Miss Maisel, this is the marvelous Mrs. Maisel show on mm-hmm. Netflix. There's one scene where her agent, Susie, has this talent that Midge has to take care of, takes him to the airport. He's this magician. He's crazy. Takes him to the yes. airport. She has to kind of shuffle him there. And he said, oh, and I got called by so-and-so agent. You know, they're really, you know, they're looking at me, da-da-da. And she said, hold on a second. Susie found you in a bar doing magic tricks for drunks. And she saw the star in you as that mm-hmm. uncut diamond. It's really easy to see a diamond once somebody's already seen it and it's on its way up. It's not so yeah. easy to identify it when it's a exactly. diamond in the rough, but you see something special in there.
Yes.
So it's very
yes.
like people are going to, in other words, you know, people are going to come at you when you, when you've got, you know, when you've got growth and things are happening, but where were those people when you started who didn't mm-hmm. believe, you know? It's very easy yeah. to invest in things that everybody wants to invest in. And then it becomes this kind of spiral effect, right? This viral, you know,
yes.
effect. But
yes.
it's hard to, when you're an entrepreneur, it's hard for people not to see what you see.
Wow, Cynthia, thank you for this. It's really amazing, you know, update and overview of, you know, what's happening. So are you optimistic? Are you
optimistic?
Always.
I think my husband always says, like, God, you wake up happy. It's really annoying.
Great.
Super annoying. But I'm always optimistic. I love to learn. I'm curious. I've done many, 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 many different jobs. You know, having not finished college, I always think I felt like I had to work harder than everybody else that was out mm-hmm. there because of that. And I think that for me gave me this sense of wonder and not fear of failing. I didn't fear the failure
yes.
because I wasn't built up to where I had all these degrees, da, 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 and then, oh, you fail. And you're like, oh, what happened? I did everything right.
Yep.
I got my MBA and I did everything. Mm-hmm. You know, because I didn't, I think it for me, it was the ability to just keep going and learning and learning
keep
and learning.
Going and you had some inherent confidence that you can, you know, prevail. I mean, anything that will come up. Right?
Yeah.
That's
and entrepreneurship is a sickness, as you know. I think we kind of live, we like it. You know, I've done
yes.
I think we just kind yes. of like it. We like the freedom it gives us to be our own boss, to do the things we want to do. I'm very optimistic about all the companies that are in the live shopping space.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's going to be a consolidation that's going to happen. I read about that
for
last
sure.
year. It's going to have to happen. There'll be some winners. There'll be some losers. But there's a lot of great key learning that's happened along the way. And I think we're just scratching the surface of what it's going to look like in 5 years is very different than what it looks like today, too.
For
which
sure.
Which is exciting.
For sure. I mean, in today's tech world, I mean, agility is like one of the most important skills, right? You need to adapt. You need to change.
Yep.
And to do it fast, right? To have the ability to, you know, to capture the opportunities in the market that are changing so fast. You know, when you started our career, one product line could sustain for 10 years, right?
Right.
It's like, it's not going to sustain. I mean, like 12 months, 18 months, and you're off to the next thing.
Exactly.
That's a skill set that the new generation need also to learn, right?
And yep.
It's very, very important.
100%.
Oh, Cynthia, it was fascinating, amazing. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
One last thing on a personal note. Could you tell us something about yourself that most people don't know?
Yeah, I grew up in Southern California and I was a surfer and skateboarder. Still
wow.
like to do, not so much skateboarding anymore. Probably afraid of breaking my neck, but surfing, when yeah. I get to California, I do surf.
Really?
And
now you have
I'm
the chance
competitive
to do that
equestrian.
In a way, right?
Yeah, when I go, I'll have more chances when I move back to LA. But
move back to LA, yeah.
Yes, yes. For sure. Well,
amazing. Cynthia, thank you so much. We appreciate the time.
No problem. Bye-bye. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. Your support means the world to us. If today's episode has been insightful for you, consider sharing it with someone who would also benefit. Even one share can make a big difference. Looking to elevate your e-commerce game? Discover Vimi, a multi-channel e-commerce platform that will transform your business with the power of shoppable video. Visit us at vimi.net to learn more. It's Vimi, V-I-M-M-I.net. Thank you for being part of our journey. Stay tuned for more invaluable insights in our next episode.